Hello, Maureen.
Hello.
So let me introduce you to tonight's speaker. Tonight we have Maureen Chen joining us from Australia, although normally Maureen would currently be based in Taiwan. Over the years, Maureen's done amazing things from what I can see. So besides establishing social welfare organizations in Hong Kong, working with NGOs for children in Cambodia, just now you were mentioning that, working with victims of landmines as well in Cambodia. That's just the tip of what Maureen has been doing. And Maureen's second passion in life to meditation and teaching meditation is non-violent communication. So we're going to have to get Maureen back to explore that with us in the future. But tonight, Maureen's going to be sharing her insights, her wisdom on building trust, whether it's an internal process for the self, or whether it's building trusts with other people, or whether it's building trust within communities. Maureen's going to be sharing with us. So I'm going to hand over to Maureen. Just before I hand over, I'm going to request you that you put your questions, you send your questions through the question and answer link, and Maureen will be taking your questions towards the end of the talk. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy Maureen, and Maureen, it's all yours. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Very nice to be with all of you. So, yeah, maybe straight into the topic because we have had a bit of a chat here. I guess my journey with trust began when I was kind of I did mention before the non-violent communication, and I guess there was a need, and this is what the NVC really looks at, what needs am I having? And I had a need for trust, to be trusted. And at that point, I'd been living in Hong Kong for 16 years, and I felt, this was a feeling I had, that I wasn't trusted, and I had a need to be trusted. And it had come to a point where it was a kind of a painful need. You know, there was a deep need to be trusted. And I ended up, not my plan, but you know, it was meant to be. I ended up in a 3-day retreat on community building. It's through the Foundation for Community Encouragement. And interestingly, I had encouraged other people to join that retreat, not knowing where it was or much about it because it cost money. And, you know, I knew it would be something good. And I read Scott Peck's book about community, so it was something I was familiar with. But then somebody was asked to sponsor to help raise funds for them, and she said, well, I'll sponsor a few people to go, and she invited me to go, and it happened to be the place I was going to get away from everything and think about things anyway. So you see how life moves us in a certain direction. So I went to this retreat on community building. We were asked to sit in a circle. There were 30 of us, about 30, and we were asked to sit in a circle and only to speak if we had sweaty palms or palpitations. And I thought, oh no, here it goes, this kind of new age mumbo jumbo. That's what I initially felt. However, I was the first one to speak, and I had palpitations so strong. I had such strong palpitations that I thought, to be fair to everyone, to be honest as a participant, I have to express myself. And I said, I've been living in Hong Kong for 16 years and I don't feel trusted. And I became quiet and the palpitations became so strong, I thought people could see them. And I added, I feel hurt. Interestingly, the heart became quiet. So it was a little lesson for me in listening to myself. And one of the rules in this is for people not to rescue, save, convert, preach. You know, these were kind of the guidelines. So people mostly just listen. And so it gives us a lot of space to really just process in that gathering what's going on for us. And what I took away from it, you know, it was a very good experience, but what I took away from it was I made a commitment to have unconditional trust. And I thought, wow, this is even bigger, I think, than unconditional love somehow. But what I felt when I made that commitment to myself, I felt a release. I felt this release that, you know, a lot of things were hinging on this trust factor. So I felt a raised energy and a freedom, an inner freedom, because I realized that I'm wanting people to trust me, but I have to just model trust, because if the people around me don't have a culture of trust, it's not going to come by, you know, by my expecting it. It's not going to come if I stop trusting, which is what my question was, because I'm often a very open person. I thought, you know, I'm trusting and I don't get the response of this. Should I stop trusting? And then I realized if I stop trusting, I will only have to make the effort to get that trust back again, because it's just like peace and love and happiness. These are intrinsic qualities. And if I lose them, then I have to get them back again to fulfill myself. So I thought, well, I have to be the model of trust. And as Gandhi said, be the change you want to see. So I have to do that. So I started to do a little, you know, deeper thinking on this whole thing of trust. And I realized that, you know, actually Hong Kong is so close to China. I mean, now it's part of China, but it had only just a few decades before come through the Cultural Revolution. So even though Hong Kong is a separate country, it was a colony under the British, but still a lot of the people had come from China, and it was very strong, the impact. So I realized that, you know, there can be a systemic kind of breaking down of trust so that there is control. So, you know, I was aware of this kind of thing happening to many people there. So trust, I think, was systematically broken to some extent. And then coupled with that is the whole commercial influence in Hong Kong, because it's a business hub. And so in business, there's not often a strong trust factor. I mean, I'll leave you to think about all of that. But what I did is I gave a talk at a school, and I asked students at the school, they were probably around 14, 15, and I asked them if they still trust. And they looked at me, I can't forget the look they gave me, but it was like, you know, you're an adult and you're asking about trust. Haven't you learned about that yet? And I just saw that there was like a belief that you just better not. And that's what when I'd ask people generally, I'd ask people, what do you think about trust in Hong Kong? And they'd mostly say, I just don't. That was the common response. So I started to explore this in any country that I went to. And of course, it was different everywhere. Australia was still a little bit innocent. And I found that mostly there was a pretty good degree of trust. So I found that interesting. So yeah, it's up to each one of us to work out our own trustworthiness, but also to understand the culture and the space that we're in. And I guess the word of the moment is unprecedented. You know, this is what we keep saying about this virus. We are living in unprecedented times. But actually on the trust level, also I would say, we have seen an unprecedented level of breaking of trust, whether it's from institutions of religion, even like how the people that I grew up with singing the songs as a child, you know, whether it's celebrities, it's like, where do we find trust? You know, the misinformation that is going around now and is always going around and seems to be increasing. The word that I think Time magazine came out with about 5 years ago, they kind of find the most common word being used. And I remember about 5-6 years ago, it was post-truth. And how does that affect trust when we're living in a post-truth era? So yeah, it's a very big topic, this whole topic of trust. But like everything else, it starts with ourselves. So I felt that I first need to see how trustworthy I am. And I took a trip to Mount Abu, to our headquarters, during this time. And I asked the head of the organization, we happened to be traveling together to on a trip that was about 4 or 5 hours. And I said to her, you know, I don't like to say this, but to be really honest, I have found that I can't trust anyone, but I don't like to say that because it's so negative. And I'm a trusting person, so it doesn't suit kind of my culture for myself. And she said something that I will never forget, and I've used since then in my life. She said, maybe see it a bit differently, that we can trust most people 95%. Most people. She gave the example, like we're sitting in this car, we trust the driver will take us to our destination safely. However, we also should see that he is not tired. You know, we should see if he needs anything, stop and ask him, do you need tea? How he's feeling? I mean, who knows? He might have not been able to sleep the night before because of a sick child. We don't know his situation. And of course, he would need the money. So we should, we could be more caring. And I realized that, yeah, very often I kind of dump trust on others. Okay, I trust you with this. And then I turn away and I expect the delivery. And I saw in the way she was speaking that trust is something that I still, it's not that I'm checking on people. And I think that's why I kind of hand over and don't get involved, because I also think it's like trusting not to be over your shoulder. But there's a way of caring that's not looking over someone's shoulder, but just traveling along with and just checking that I've given all I can to help them to fulfill the duty. So when I came back from India, I heard that someone I was very close to had said something negative about me. And normally I would use that language. See, you can't trust anyone. But now with this new 95% rule, I thought, okay, well, you know, 95% is okay. I'll give her this as part of her 5%. And I hope she gives me the same. Because I know I could say something about someone. I would like to think I would never do that, but you know, it happens. And so I just thought, oh, I hope she gives me the same if it happens in reverse. But this 95%, so okay, I can't say I don't trust her. I still trust her 95%. So this has been a very good guide in my life. I mean, some people you need to, you know, think more. You give, you know, you can trust them 80%. But what I realized is that I was unrealistic, that we can't trust anyone 100%. I can't trust myself 100%. And I don't want anyone to trust me 100% because I still make mistakes. And so we need to be realistic when it comes to trust. So that was a very big lesson and a guidance for my life. But coming back to this retreat and my commitment to live with unconditional trust. So I came back from this retreat feeling great, feeling, yes, I can do this and I'm going to model trust. You know, when I walked back into the center, there was a message on the spike at our reception. And it said, Joe is in hospital. He has AIDS. This is his telephone number. Can you please call him? Now, that's really breaking confidentiality. Somebody put that note, and between us, we could never work out who put that note up to today. But I went to the hospital the next day to meet Joe. It's not his real name, but I went to the hospital to meet Joe. And he was on 112 tablets a day. It was when AIDS was quite new and there was a lot of experimental drugs. So obviously he had a lot of health issues, malfunction of the liver, multiple skin abscesses, a T cell count that if I remember correctly, was just 19. And quite irresponsibly and innocently, I said to him, well, you better just check out of here because, you know, your immune system is so compromised to be in a public ward of a hospital. I said, you should just check out of here, stop your medication, start meditating, be vegetarian. And the next day he called me and said, oh, I've checked out of the hospital. Have you got any suggestion where I can stay? I was a bit shocked because I think I didn't expect him to act on that. And I felt I was really not very responsible in even suggesting it. But anyway, I went with it. And I called a few people. And of course, people were terrified of AIDS in those days. But I called one person. He was with the Humanist Association, Toby, and he said, thank you for thinking about me. He's very welcome. And it was on an island and a nice retreat place. So he went there. And so that was a big journey of trust. I had made this promise for unconditional trust, and I was getting the lessons thick and fast, because the next thing, he's at the center. And so I was quickly reading up on all the latest, and it said, you know, the way of transmission, and you can't contract AIDS by sharing utensils. And so I said to the people in the center, the students, you know, Joe has AIDS. Are you comfortable for him to be around? And they said, if you feel it's okay, we feel it's okay. So I felt so much trust from the students. But what I was doing is I was using his utensils after he had used them without washing them. Of course, it was a little hard for me because I wanted to wash them to make sure. But I thought, if I'm exposing the people in the center to this, I have to expose myself fully. And so if I knew he had used a glass or a plate or a spoon, I would use that without washing it again to kind of have that integrity of being trusted and trusting the situation. But then, of course, one person became fearful and didn't believe all of this and said, no, I don't believe it. You can contract AIDS through sharing utensils. He has to have his own utensils. And I said, well, actually, that's discrimination because he doesn't need to have his own utensils. So I think we can't do that. And that person influenced a lot of the other students, if not all. And so I lost the trust of everyone. Partly it was because of Joe himself, who was a smoker and came to our morning class, and he would reek of cigarette smell. But to get rid of the smell of the cigarette, he would put aftershave. And so, of course, you know, the atmosphere of meditation center is quite different, and people didn't want to sit next to him. And he was a larger than life personality. He was a great singer and very multicultural and lived on the streets for many years, so very survivalist, quite a personality. And then he ended up in remand because he tried to overdose on heroin, or I think it was heroin, but anyway, he tried to overdose on drugs in the hospital, and he didn't die, so he was charged with possession. So by this time, I'd lost the trust of the students, and I was secretly going to visit him at the remand center, which was also very, very uncomfortable for me because I'm quite an honest person. I don't usually hide things, but I was hiding the fact that I was going to see him. And the stress of sitting amongst other family members and friends and in that in the remand center was very stressful because I was imagining what everyone's going through, and you could feel the atmosphere, and people were known by only their number, and it was a stressful place for me to visit because I just couldn't imagine, you know, what people were going through. So I still had the trust of our seniors because I told them what was going on, and I told them I can't turn him away because, you know, for me, I would consider it like turning him away from God's door, and this is where he's come for help. And he was happy and peaceful, and he'd had a great meditation experience that was very healing. In fact, his T cell count had come to a reasonable level. All of the symptoms had disappeared, so he had no physical symptoms. I was in touch with his buddy and people that were, you know, treating him. So I kind of had an awareness. But then I found out that not only was all this going on, but I found out he was a pathological liar, a diagnosed pathological liar. So I was like, oh my gosh, how do I even trust my own discernment now? He came out of remand, and that's when I found out about this diagnosis, and things started to disappear from the center, and I was trying to trust, and I thought, he needs to be trusted. Otherwise, how will he change? Because my vision, my thinking will affect him. So I was really experimenting with trust on so many different levels, but ultimately I found out that things had gone a bit too far. He was borrowing from students, and yes, you can imagine all the things I was going through. And he was cheeky enough to say, because I said to him, I've never come across someone like you. So when I'd kind of complain to him about him, he'd say, but you're learning a lot, aren't you? So I had to kind of wear it because, yes, I'd kind of asked for this lesson. But anyway, what I had to do then is tell our students, look, Barry's, well, Joe is in a going through a hard time, and he of course needs money. Things are not easy, but we don't borrow or lend money at the center. That's one of our policies. And if you do happen to lend him any money, don't even tell me about it. If he doesn't pay you back, it's totally on you, because it's, and don't lend him because he's connected to the center, because that's what, when I spoke to the people who he'd borrowed from, I said, but why did you lend it to him? You know that he can't pay you back. They said, oh, but you know, he's at the center, so I thought I should do the right thing. And so I started to ask people, you know, keep your bags with you. And I told him, you know, I'm sorry, you can't come back to the center because, you know, people let down their guard. I'll meet you outside, but I can't let you come into the center because there's been too much going on. So as you can see, there was lesson after lesson in this unconditional trust I was trying to practice. So that was my journey. That was my journey of, you know, the intense training in trust. But of course, it took me back to looking at how I can be trusted. Of course, it's not just a matter of a feeling. It's not just a matter of, you know, like walking into a meditation center or into a church or here or there and just trusting everyone. We also have to be wise in these days, and, you know, we keep a culture of trust and we model trust in this environment. However, we need to be sensible. So when we entrust anyone, we need to see, first of all, that they have the competence. So if I take on a duty, I have to check also, do I have the competence? And can I be responsible? Because even though my nature is to be responsible, circumstances these days don't even facilitate that for us. I mean, a lot of people have not been able to be responsible towards their loved ones because of the lockdown. There are so many situations and circumstances. So I think I need to reflect on these, whether I can be competent, whether I can be responsible, whether I have the communication channels that I need to be able to communicate what needs to be communicated as things keep changing and evolving or devolving. And I also need to see that I have the right intention. So do I have intention that is looking for the best interest for you if I'm taking something on, and for me? Because we also learn through this that I can't serve you at the expense of myself. I need to bring my whole self into this, otherwise it also doesn't work. So I have really delved into, you know, this whole aspect of trust. And I'm just looking at how we're going for time here. Okay, so Artie, I think we have another 10 or 15 minutes for...
Yes, you've got another 15 minutes comfortably.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I then came back from Hong Kong for a few years to Australia, and I was living in a retreat center. So that's another good opportunity where there's maybe 10 residents and many volunteers coming and going. So there's a lot of trust in that environment on many different levels, because people say they will come and help and you've got like 50 people coming for a retreat. So you do depend on those people. But circumstances are such that it doesn't always work out. And I also realize that we make a lot of assumptions. So when people were coming to live at our retreat center, to stay there for an extended period, unless we had a very clear agreement, it didn't work out. And I saw it wouldn't work out, because people would come for their own reasons. I'm not saying in a selfish way, but they think, oh, I like to volunteer. I like to live in a place that's very peaceful. I like to live in a community. So they come for these good reasons. They're not, you know, they're not wrong. However, sometimes they're not aware of the expectations of them. And if they're not spelt out very clearly, that leads to a lot of misunderstanding. So we decided at the retreat center to draw up agreements and have people sign agreements before they moved in. And there was a bit of a reaction to this as well, because people felt, well, this is a spiritual organization. How can you have this kind of agreement? It's very corporate. You know, there was a reaction to a changed culture. But I think we are in changing times. And what was probably, you know, like people would agree on a handshake in earlier times, that doesn't exist much anymore. I mean, I have learned through my association in Hong Kong that partners, you know, people that have been friends or family for 30, 40 years, the trust can break down. So, you know, we need agreements. There was one particular story of a woman who had more or less made these two boys like her own children because of their family circumstances. And they were in the company with her husband in Dubai. She was based in Hong Kong, but the business was in Dubai. And her husband passed away. And her friend said to her, "You should draw up an agreement with the boys." And she said, "No, they're like my own sons. I mean, what are you talking about? They've been with me for years." You know, those two boys took away everything from her own children, from her. They took the whole thing away. So, you know, we just have to make things clear. And that's a very sad reality. There was a woman I trusted completely in Cambodia. And I trusted her more than I trust myself. I mean, that's how I saw her integrity. And, you know, that didn't really work out. And she said, you know, I had what she called it pure greed. She was running an NGO and I don't know. Anyway, these things happen. So agreements are very, very important. And it was great to have that at our retreat center because people would say that they would like to come and live there and help. And when they got the agreement and it said that they need to put in, because this is what we need. If they're there, they need to put in, depending on the kind of level of commitment they were making, between 20 and 40 hours a week, because this is what we need. If someone's there, they're taking a place, you know, an accommodation space, and they're provided with accommodation and food and everything. So, you know, depending on their level of commitment and their financial situation, there was an agreement drawn up. And some people said, "Oh, I can't do that." And I said, "It's so good that we know ahead of time. Otherwise, things will get messy. People would move in and then on weekends, which is when we have our retreats, they would go off. And that's the time we need them." So we had to have agreements that they would be there on weekends, that they would come to meetings. So communication was clear. And I just felt without that, it wouldn't work. And also, I was with quite a mature group of people at that time. So even though I was the coordinator, well, I would say I was a real coordinator. I coordinated. I wasn't the boss in the sense that people would say, "You should do this, you should do that." And I'd say, "Put it on the agenda. We'll discuss it at the meeting. We'll decide together." And that was the best management experience I've had. And it was based on trust to a great extent, that we're all in this together. And it was a great maturity. So I think agreements, maybe third parties to see that things are being upheld, like there was a conflict between two people. Can you imagine, you know, we work with a Living Values Education Program, and I use the book to do the conflict resolution with these two people. And I just followed the book. You know, we didn't feel we needed to bring in someone else. We just followed the book. And it said that if people aren't following the agreements, then, you know, it has to go to another level. So, yeah, we had an outside person, an outside psychologist who came on board to talk to these two people. So if they weren't going forward with the agreements and with their consultancy with this person, then one of them who wasn't following the agreement would have to move on. So things were made very clear. And I think that clarity is so important in a trust factor, because otherwise there's so much assumption, even the assumption that if you're a meditator, if you're a you know, a spiritual person, that you will be loving more than lawful, that you will oversee most of the things that go on, you know, this kind of thing. There's an expectation that is also not realistic when it comes to management. So yeah, there's been many, many, many lessons over the years. And I was asked earlier by Arti what I feel is the difference with Hong Kong and Taiwan. And Taiwan has one of the highest trust factors I've ever experienced. I mean, I was saying that people don't, people can leave their bicycles outside with their helmets on it, not locked. You know, people just generally say, oh, don't worry, you can trust people here. That's kind of the way people talk. Of course, it's not 100%. I don't think anywhere is. And with regards to this pandemic, there's a high social trust. So the social trust is that people will take care of themselves. And so there's been no lockdown. Schools have stayed open. Universities have stayed open. The borders, to some extent, have been closed to some countries with regards to flights. People have been given, you know, they are monitoring people when they are in self-quarantine. So they're quite strict in all this monitoring. However, there's generally a social trust that people feel that if you are in amongst other people, you are practicing the hygiene that's recommended and you are looking after yourself. And so social trust is a very interesting factor that I've learned through this pandemic and seen modeled in Taiwan. Another thing that has worked there, because I don't know the latest statistics, but last I read it was only 6 deaths, for about 400 people have been infected. And this was in a place that has a population of the same population of Australia, 24 million, in a tiny island, half the size of our little island called Tasmania. It's a very small place. So people can't do the social distancing. People are living sometimes on top of each other in their residence. So people old and young are not able to be separated. So it's very interesting to see how powerful social trust is. So yeah, a lot of experiences still continuing, but I love this trust that I'm seeing and observing in Taiwan. So if there's any questions, it'd be a good time for those. I've really shared a lot. I think, I hope it wasn't too much.
Not at all. Thank you very much. Maureen, would you mind doing the meditation first? A short meditation. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
That will give people a chance to get their questions in.
Yeah. So yes, let's go into some time of reflection on this very important topic of trust. It's an aspect of life that can't be avoided. People trust me, and I need to trust others. I can't even walk outside my door or get in a car without trust. It's in the very fabric of society at every level, every level. But it always starts with myself. To what extent can I be trusted? What do I need to put in place in my own life? What changes do I need to make in myself? So that I can build my trustworthiness. People place their trust in me. Do I have the best intentions? For both the person who is placing their trust and for myself. Because everything is mutual. Of course, I often need to put others ahead in circumstances. Am I willing to do that? Have I got the capacity to do that? Whilst caring for myself, am I also unselfish? Selfishness comes from fear, survival. Can I trust in a higher source? However you see that, can I trust that I will be taken care of if I stretch myself? I will be empowered to fulfill whatever it is that I've taken on. What is my personal experience of this aspect of letting go and letting God? I know for myself, there have been many unbelievable experiences of that. So the trust in my capacity has a very strong spiritual element to it. I can be an instrument for things beyond what I ever imagined. But I need to prepare myself to be that instrument. I need to be clean and clear, like a flute. Empty of any selfish desires. An instrument for greater good. Om Shanti.
Thank you, Maureen. We've got a couple of questions that have come through. The first one is, I understand the need to have formal agreements for many things, including with close business partners, establishments, even close friends. Do you think those who resist, as you describe, because they think it's not spiritual trusting, are actually acting out of some unconscious motive to take advantage of or defraud others?
I think that is often the case, in fact. And also people come from fear. So people don't often have a trust in themselves, so are not willing to commit. It's not that they have an intention. I don't think they generally have an intention to not fulfill, but they can't trust that they can. Like, for example, there was a young man that used to sit at our reception, and we always need people to look after our reception in Hong Kong. We needed that. And he would sit there for hours. But if I asked him, if I'd say, I've just got to go out for 20 minutes, can you just be here? He'd say, no. So there's a fear of commitment. You know, that was very strange because he'd sit there for hours. But if I tried to commit him for 15, 20 minutes, he couldn't. And that's often because of, you know, people punishing, being punitive when people have taken responsibility. I think there's things behind that also. So sometimes it's an avoidance of commitment because of a ulterior motive, but very often it's just not trusting the self. I work with in a drug rehab center in Asia, and the people there, they said that they were scared to be released because they couldn't trust themselves. They said, in here I can, because I don't have access to drugs, but I don't know if I can trust myself. And they wanted to trust themselves. It was painful that they couldn't trust themselves. So a lot of people can't trust themselves. This is a very big thing.
Wow. It's very interesting. The next question, I find it difficult to trust people, especially in relationships. How do I build trust after betrayal?
Well, I think this is where the nonviolent communication also really helps, because communication can solve most things. In fact, in the drug rehab center I was in Argentina, they said addiction, and you know, they're Spanish speaking, right? But they said addiction comes from no diction. So they were very responsive to the nonviolent communication because they felt diction, you know, being able to put into words what's going on. Not being able to put into words what's going on is the cause of addiction. Now that's very deep and I think very insightful. So what we learn with the nonviolent communication is everything that people do comes from a sense of need. So if someone has so betrayed some trust, what was the need that they were trying to fulfill? What were they needing? If I can have a conversation and get to the needs and feelings, I can begin to understand. It's not easy. I mean, it's a very deep aspect. But, yeah.
Wow, thank you. The next question's very nice. Have you had any situation when you've put trust in someone who others wouldn't trust and been rewarded for doing so?
Yeah, very often. Because I think, you know, sometimes I can see people's potential, but not just that, I need. When we're running voluntary organizations and we see someone has an ability that can be used to serve, of course we encourage it. So I don't know if that's selfish or unselfish, but it's for the greater good. So I really do encourage people when I see that they have a potential, and they often don't see that potential, and others don't always see it. But, you know, it often is amazing what people, like even the lady that's staying with me now in Taiwan, she's actually Korean. She's only studied Chinese for a year in China. Her Chinese is not that great. However, I really appreciate the culture she has, because she has the culture that's suitable for Taiwan. And so language, I think, is secondary. So people feel, why are you putting trust in her for being a helper in Taiwan when she can't even really speak the language? Because I think language is not everything. And I think she's wonderful for building up our center and our contacts there. I trust her culture that she brings in there. And what I mean by culture is not just the tea, but the respect and the gentleness, the finesse. That's so very beautiful.
Next question. How do you trust if you keep being disappointed by people you place your trust in?
Yeah, I think one of the eight powers that we learn in the Brahma Kumaris is the power to discern. And so I do need to discern the level of trust and maybe drop my expectations a little bit, and or maybe see what I need to do to help facilitate what needs to be achieved. It's a big thing to get things done when there is a, you know, not that trust factor there. That's a reality. I'm not saying, you know, it's not that we can't just have blind trust. There needs to be a trust built on, like I said, competence, communication, transparency. That's an interesting thing too, because I think communication helps in transparency. So in this culture where we can't trust as much as we would like to, at least we have to work on transparency, because that helps.
How do you prepare yourself to be an instrument of trust? Often we become like a pushover and are taken advantage of when we trust. So what are the steps we need to take?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'm also interested in is boundaries. So I think we do need to place boundaries so that we are not taken advantage of, or even just pushed. You know, like I had a job in Hong Kong, and I was asked to do something, but I was working for an association. The members would call me, like sometimes three of them would call in one day, whether I've done it yet. So I made it very clear. I said, I will take 1 week to do this after you ask me, because it involved another organization. I said, it will take 1 week. Don't call me within 1 week. I will deliver within 1 week, but don't call me. And if they call me, I'd remind them. I'd say, please, you know, I said I would need 1 week, so please don't call. I need 1 week to do this. So I had to kind of train them not to call me every few hours or every day to get this thing done. Because it wasn't logical. You know, you can't give me something and then the next day call me, because obviously I can't do it in 1 day. So I set boundaries in dealing with this particular organization. And same with you know, people that I live with and associate with. We have to balance our unconditional love with boundaries.
Final question. What if you can't speak to the person? How do you heal yourself?
Yeah, this was actually, you know, I mentioned that retreat I went to. That was very interesting, because sitting in silence and having a space of empathy where people are just there to listen to themselves and listen to others when they are speaking authentically. You know, what I saw in that retreat is that, you know, sometimes people would just speak because it was uncomfortable to sit in silence, or people would speak because they wanted to show what they know. But when people spoke from that heart space and from their truth, they spoke very little, and what they spoke was so impactful. So if I, you know, can have a little gathering, we did practice this afterwards, and we'd just have a small gathering of 4 or 5 people, sit in silence, and people would only speak if they were moved to speak. And I would sometimes go there and not say a word, but learn a lot and settle a lot of things in myself, just being in that space. I know it sounds very esoteric, but it works.
Well, it brings us to the end of our evening here in London. And I think it's the beginning of your day in Australia, rather early, around 4:30.
Very early day. Our meditation time, yeah.
So, Maureen, would you like to tell everybody about the book that, again, once more, that they can get on Kindle?
Yeah, I've just written a book. It's called Mystic at the Edge. I'm waiting for the proof. So I'm expecting to see the first copy on Monday or Tuesday. So it's very new, but it is available, I think, already on Kindle. But I don't even know, because it's that new. It's just kind of in process. But Mystic at the Edge is my journey from about the age of 21. Doesn't go much into the childhood, but up to now. So it's my spiritual journey, traveling, living in many different countries, dealing with all the issues that come up in daily life. So it's a spiritual travelogue. I'm sharing in that about the things that have helped me, that I've needed, like a deeper understanding on love, on trust, boundaries, non-violent communication, and also worldviews. So because I think my philosophy, how I see the world, impacts a lot in the way I can sit in this world, you know, how I can function in this world. And I was sharing before, one of the quotes that has really served me throughout my life is wisdom is passion and tranquility. So philosophy has really given me the tranquility to be able to see things in a way that I can keep moving, hopefully with wisdom. So wisdom is passion and tranquility. I always had a lot of passion, but I needed tranquility. So yeah, the book should be, if you Google Mystic at the Edge on Amazon, I think maybe by next week, you should be able to get it.
There have been a number of thank yous, Maureen, for your insightful talk, for a beautiful talk, for the inspirations you're leaving us with. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much for joining, all of you.